In our last case today, 2023-0294, State of Ohio versus Sheckles. In place of Justice Dieters, remaining today is Judge John Eklund of the 11th District Court of Appeals. Thank you, Judge Eklund, for taking this case as well. We appreciate you being here today.
Thank you.
On behalf of the state, Mr. Springman. So, I have a note that you're sharing time with the state. Is that true?
The Deputy Solicitor General, yes, I am, Your Honor. Reserving 6 minutes for the Deputy Solicitor General and then reserving 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay.
And I will begin my 7 minutes on the what I believe is a core issue of this case, and that is whether or not the exclusionary rule can be invoked when there is non-compliance with a federal regulation.
Well, first, let's focus on something.
Yes.
Is it really a motion to suppress versus a motion to limine here? What are we really talking about?
You are talking about a motion to suppress because when it's not the state that determines whether or not a motion in limine gets converted into a motion to suppress, it is the nature of the relief sought. And in the motion in limine, it is very clear that Mr. Sheckles was seeking the exclusion of Kessler's testimony. And it's very clear that the basis for that exclusion involved the federal regulations known as the TUI regulations. And the entry that the judge put on that was journalized on June 1st, a couple weeks or a week after the decision, says very clearly Attorney John Zachary Kessler failed to produce the required TUI letter, and that's why his testimony is being excluded.
I thought there was something about he had it, or the lawyer had it on his cell phone or something.
Yes, we can. You know, that you can go down, we can go down the rabbit hole and the red herrings of whether or not the state had a TUI letter, did not have a TUI letter. It certainly was trying to get a TUI letter on the day of this hearing after the motion in limine was filed.
Skip that for a second. Did Sheckles have standing to raise this issue, or is it really the government, the DOJ?
It really falls on Kessler, I believe, to... he's the one that would have faced consequences flowing from not following the federal regulations or the TUI regulations. So he was the one that had to make sure or be concerned that he had the authority to testify. But it, again, what we're talking about here is the overexpansive use of the exclusionary rule to a federal regulation. And there's a plethora of case law that says the exclusionary rule does not apply to a regulatory violation. The seminal case on this was back in 1979. It was the United States Supreme Court decision in Caseros. And then I cited State versus Rutherford, I believe, as a Sixth Circuit case that discusses Caseros. And the twin rationales are very clear as to why the exclusionary rule shouldn't apply to a federal regulation. The first is it creates a separation of powers issue because federal agency that writes the regulations is free to determine what penalty it's going to adopt if someone violates those regulations. And second, according to the Supreme Court, they want to encourage federal agencies from adopting protective regulations, and if there's they use the term over-inclusive use of the exclusionary rule whenever federal regulations are violated, that would discourage federal agencies then from writing those protective measures for violations of the federal regulations. So there's very, very solid case law, and I think it's a new issue before this court where a state court judge used the exclusionary rule because there was a purported violation of these TUI regulations.
Now, if we're to treat the motion as the order as an exclusionary order and invoke the exclusionary rule, they're nevertheless dealing with non-constitutional issues, both motions, or the, both rulings on the videotape and on the witness testifying. Yes. And in a normal course of things, the trial court has some measure of discretion in acting upon matters of admissibility of evidence.
Yes.
So what's our standard of review when you've got kind of a mixture of a suppression motion and an evidentiary question of a non-constitutional nature?
Yes, Your Honor, the standard of review is going to be that's applied to a motion to suppress, meaning it's a mixed question of law and fact. So, yeah, we take the facts, make sure they're not clearly erroneous, that the trial court's interpretation of the facts are not clearly erroneous, and then we take those facts and apply it to the applicable law.
All right.
So that's the standard of review according to the case law. Whenever a motion in limine is converted into a motion to suppress.
Do you know of any situation where a judge would be required to make someone observe the requirements of federal law? This situation I'm looking at it, and the Code of Federal Regulations says it applies in state court matters, but the duty is the duty on the part of the court, or is it the duty on the part of the witness and who the witness answers to?
Your Honor, the duty is on the part of the witness. The witness, in this case, the federal employee, wants to make sure that they are not running afoul of the federal regulations. Again, here, the Department of Justice, the whole reason behind the TUI regulations is they want to limit information that the employee has gleaned from their employment from the Department of Justice. So
does that, let's suppose there is a violation, does that in any way mar the testimony for the purposes of the state proceeding?
It should not, no. It should not at all, because, again, any rights here or any consequences, I should say, that flow from Mr. Kessler's testimony are on him. And he's the one that has to be concerned and has to assert those rights. Mr. Shekels doesn't really have standing to assert those rights. I mean, they belong to Mr. Kessler.
And what about the video? Are you going to be addressing that, or will the Attorney General?
I'll be glad to address the video. You know, I'm mindful that my time here is up, my divided time, but I can leave that for the Attorney General since...
Thank you.
I have 6 minutes left. All right, thank you.
Mr. Keller, good morning.
Good morning, Chief Justice Kennedy, and may it please the court. The lower courts were wrong to discard valuable evidence of an attempted murder here, and that's both because the Department of Justice's TUI regulations are not a way for private parties to exclude evidence, and because the standards for authenticating video evidence are just far less complicated than the lower courts made them out to be. Before getting into those, I do want to pause on the jurisdictional issue, and I'll just add to what the state said that this court's standards, if you look at cases like Davidson and Basham, are really about the definitiveness of the ruling. And if we had any doubts here, I think they should end if you look at pages 36 to 37 of the May 25th proceedings. And that's where the state asked the court to reconsider its ruling after it had already made them. And the trial court was very dismissive of the idea that it would overrule itself. So the state really had no choice at that point but to appeal. It would have been very foolish to go to trial. Now, to go to the authenticity issue with Justice Bruner asked about, it's important to remember we're talking about the initial admission of evidence, not the ultimate weight to be assigned. And it's a very, if you look at Rule 901, it's a very low threshold, and it's a very flexible inquiry. It can be proved both through direct evidence and circumstantial evidence. So here, all Rule 901 asks is, was there sufficient evidence to support a finding that this video was what the state says it was? And the bar owner's testimony certainly gets us there. She confirmed that the bar had 4 security cameras. She confirmed that those cameras recorded onto a hard drive. She confirmed that the state came and took the hard drive that had the raw footage for the scene of the crime. And then she also confirmed on the back end that the ultimate summary video, she had received it on her phone. This is at page 31. I know there was a little confusion initially about whether she had watched the whole video, but if you look at the questioning and how it proceeded, she confirmed she had watched the video on her phone, and if you look at the trial court's ruling on the next page, on page 32, it actually accepted that she had seen the video, and it ruled on a separate legal mistake, which was this idea that you needed to have a compilation witness. There is no requirement of a compilation witness who splices together the video. This court's decision in Pickens recognized that an authentication witness...
Was all the video available, though?
Yes, it was, Your Honor. There's a little bit of confusion.
It's unclear sometimes in there.
No, it was a little bit of confusion in the May 25th proceeding.
So rule 1006 was met.
I'm sorry?
Rule 1006 was met.
It was, Your Honor. So it was disclosed in the discovery demand in January of 2020, so over 2 years before trial. And it was disclosed, and basically, I believe the discovery response was phrased in terms of inspection. And I think what happened was the state later on ultimately provided the compilation video. And I, as far as I can tell from the record, the defense counsel never actually requested to come and see the raw footage. And all, as your question noted, all you need from 1006 is to make available to the other side the raw footage.
So quick question. So this witness did not observe the shooting, correct?
Correct. We're proceeding under the silent witness theory, correct.
I understand, but it is clear in the record that the video was edited. I mean, that there was editing that occurred. I mean, because did the length of all the separate videos from the 4 different cameras added together equal the length of what was presented in the compiled video?
So the video was certainly a summary video spliced together from the raw footage. But what matters here is for initial admissibility, for authentication, the bar owner certainly gave us enough circumstantial evidence to know that what happened here was that the state took the raw footage, it took the hard drive, and she was able to confirm that the ultimate product authentically showed what her bar looked like on the night in question, which is what's required under Midland. So any further issue about whether the video was manipulated or something like that goes to the ultimate weight. It's similar to this
court. So how is this any different from chain of custody? I mean, it's really not.
It's not, Your Honor. And this court has chain of custody cases, including the Ritchie case, that say whether or not there's a state doesn't need to prove a perfect chain of custody. Any issue about contamination goes to ultimate weight, not initial admissibility. And that's Ritchie and the cases that follow.
But wasn't it the state that actually compiled the video? You couldn't bring in the employee of who did it?
The state didn't want to die on this hill, Your Honor. It tried to get the compilation video, and we're actually in a situation where if the trial court would have had probably an hour more of patience, we probably all could have avoided what's going to turn out to be 2 years of appellate proceedings. But in terms of technical requirements under Rule 901, no. This court's decisions in Pickens and Midland do not suggest you need a compilation witness. I see I'm getting into the state's rebuttal time, and I want to be respectful of that. The one thing I would point out on TUI that hasn't come up so far is that if you look at the plain language of the 0.21D provision of the regulation, in addition to there not being an exclusionary rule, in addition to the department being the holder of the right, the regulations just say on their face that they're for internal guidance only. Thank you. We ask that you reverse both rulings.
Thank you. Good morning, Ms. Peters. Yes, it is.
Barely.
Your Honors, Chief Justice Kennedy, may it please the court. My name is Laura Peters, and I'm a member of the Hamilton County Public Defender's Office, and I represent Santez Shekels in this matter. In the simplest terms, this case boils down to whether the trial court correctly granted two motions in limine against the state.
Let's go back to my first question. Are we talking a motion to suppress or a motion in limine?
My understanding is that a motion to suppress is based on a constitutional violation, whereas a motion in limine addresses any other evidentiary issues, such as a violation of a statute or competency. So it's really is a motion in limine, but for purposes of being able to address it as a final appealable order, it's when it excludes the evidence that the state can't present it. That's when they treat it as...
Well, in your view, then, what's our standard of review?
Abuse of discretion.
Okay.
And this court, like the First District, should find that the trial court did not abuse its discretion because the state's contentions are not supported by the record in three significant aspects. One, the trial court did not procedurally err in granting the motions. It was not a definitive ruling in motion limine. There's nothing in the trial court's pronouncement of its rulings at the May 25th trial date setting that it would not actually reconsider it. And
Did the state preserve its ability to remake the motion in limine by objecting at the time that the trial court granted the motion in limine the first time?
When what the state did when the trial court granted the motion in limine, like when it granted the motion in limine to exclude Mr. Kessler's testimony, the state immediately indicated it was going to appeal.
So we don't really have a record to know whether the trial court would have denied it a second time once we got into trial.
That's correct, and we don't know that what the trial court would have done that the case had proceeded to trial that day as it was scheduled to, if they had produced the TUI letter and said, we have the TUI letter, here it is, that the trial court wouldn't have then allowed the testimony. So because it's the state's decision to immediately appeal at that moment, so we're locked into what the trial court had. What did the trial court have at that moment? It didn't have any evidence of the TUI letter. The witness said that he needed the TUI. I mean, from the get-go, the state likes to make this about an exclusionary rule and whether the federal regulation should really, there's a separation of powers. But what we're dealing with is we don't actually have any representation by the state at the trial court level saying, no, don't apply these federal regulations to us. Instead, you have them at page 4 of the transcript saying, we are seeking this TUI letter. The witness is saying, I need this TUI letter to tell me what I'm authorized to testify to.
Does the witness say that, or does the court say he has to have a TUI letter?
The witness at page, I believe, 19.
The witness wasn't refusing to testify without a letter, was he?
The witness actually never actually affirmatively says, I'm going to testify even if I don't have this TUI letter. The representation that he makes is that we're seeking the TUI letter from the Department of Justice.
Wasn't that because the defense had raised that issue?
Well, and there's also the federal regulations that make it clear that he cannot disclose any information and he cannot testify without the authorization from the Department of Justice. And
isn't that his problem? It's not an evidentiary privilege.
Well, it is, but it is a ban on the disclosure of evidence. And the United States versus Nixon, which is cited in my brief, that court said it was a jurisdictional limitation on the trial court, on a state court, that if this information is not available because of the Department of Justice says, no, you can't have it, then it's not available.
But the Department of Justice didn't say that in this case, right?
Well, the Department of Justice was reviewing the situation. So we know that it was presented to the Department of Justice, and it's the privilege of the Department of Justice, not Mr. Kessler, the decision of whether...
So if it's a privilege of the Department of Justice, and if they didn't assert it, then how can that be a basis for excluding it?
It's not necessarily a privilege. It is the regulations set out a ban. So this is not a violation of the federal regulations. It's actually the trial court enforcing the federal regulation, saying there's this ban in place. The Department of Justice is examining this because we know this because the state represented. We have sought permission this morning from the Department of Justice to get this testimony authorized.
Didn't the prosecutor... Over here.
Oh, sorry.
Didn't the prosecutor say, I have it on my phone? And then the judge said, well, it's not on my desk?
That's a little bit too much of a summary of what the actual testimony is. What the testimony is on page, I believe it's around page 19, is that Mr. Kessler said that it was his belief and his information that a copy of the TUI authorization had been emailed to Mark Pietmeyer and that he had a copy. When asked specifically, is it on your phone? He says, it is as far as I know, which is not a definitive statement actually proving that he had the TUI letter. The trial court made the finding and the First District accepted that representation that they didn't produce the TUI letter. And furthermore—
Doesn't that seem a little arbitrary rather than just to wait and see if they actually received it on a technical issue like this?
No, I wouldn't say it was arbitrary. The trial court said, I want to see it, or it's not on my desk. And more importantly, on page 37, when the state comes back to ask for reconsideration, the trial court makes the statement, it's still not on my desk. Now, is anyone familiar with the Hamilton County Courthouse and the prosecutor's office knows how close in proximity they are together? That it should have been easy for, if they had the TUI letter, for someone to bring it over. So it begs the question, why did the state never read the TUI letter if it was on the phone into the record? Why it didn't show email, someone print off a copy and send it over to the trial court? The trial court at that point in time, when it's reconsidering it, had nothing different. It still didn't have the TUI letter. There was no indication.
But the Code of Federal Regulations specifies that there's no right to third-party enforcement of this statute.
No.
So why did, I mean, you can bring it up to the trial court, but wouldn't that be an indication to the trial court that, well, this is Kessler's problem and not mine?
The trial court is a gatekeeper of the evidence. The trial court should not be permitting a federal or current or former federal employee to violate federal regulations, as the First District determined and cited the case of a Boron Oil versus Downey. There's a supremacy clause issue involved in that this is the information that belongs to the Department of Justice.
But except, I'm going to read this to you. This subpart is intended to only to provide guidance for internal operations of the Department of Justice, not intended to or not relied on to create any right or benefit, substantive or procedural, enforceable at law by a party against the United States. I guess that's against the United States.
Right. I was going to point out that's the language that they conveniently leave off. So if the Department of Justice had issued a TUI letter without actually going through what the regulations, because there's 28 CFR 16.2425, I believe 2 and 26, they detail who's supposed to do it, what's the standard that they're supposed to review. If they don't follow their own procedures, you can't use it against them, is essentially what that's saying to me.
Yeah, understandable. But can you get on, spend a little more time on the issue that we really haven't spent a lot of time discussing, and that is the fact that the video was not authenticated by someone who actually saw the shooting or by someone who actually prepared the video.
Correct, and that's why, and the trial court didn't err in making that determination. Admittedly, yes, the bar on authentication is low, but there still needs to be some evidence that the video is what the proponent claims it to be. And in this case, the proponent, the state, was claiming that this video showed the incident of the shooting. But what we know is that there were at least four different security cameras, that from the four different camera videos, they were cut and spliced together. The state represented there was hours and hours of raw video footage. I don't believe it's in the record, and this video isn't available for this court to review, that how long this compilation video is. We don't know this, so someone put together a sequence of events to say this is how the shooting happened. But we don't have anyone, the witness could not testify to that because she didn't witness it.
So do you think any time there's a compilation video or a video has been edited, the state's required to bring in the person who did that?
I'm sorry, I didn't, you trailed off at the end.
Is your position that any time a video has been edited, altered, the state needs to bring in the person who did that?
That would be the best person, but no, I would not say that that would be the only person, because in other scenarios, not in this case, someone who was there, who was present, who saw the shooting, let's say they saw the shooting, and that there was a compilation.
So the state has to either have the technical person who put the video together, or someone who can testify that they saw everything in that video happen.
In order to
authenticate.
Yes.
That's a pretty high burden, right? Well, that's not something that most courts do today, is it?
Well, in this court, in State versus Pickens, the state relies upon. What you see is there was actually a lot more detailed information provided by the property manager in that case versus what you have the testimony in this case. This witness didn't testify as to the reliability of the equipment. She didn't testify.
You need someone on the testify on the reliability of the equipment too.
Under the silent witness theory, yes, you need someone who can establish.
So someone's got to come in and say, "This is a video camera. This is how it works. This is why it's reliable."
That's what the silent witness theory is.
What about a regular camera? Do you need that? You need that witness to say how a camera works?
No, but you need
someone to testify how a camera's made.
Well, with a silent witness, with the right to cross-examine your adverse witnesses, without someone authenticating that at least here this was cut out and this was cut out, is there any way to cross-examine the person who created the video as to why they left certain parts out of the video or why they put them in a certain order because there were four different cameras? Is there any opportunity to do that as it was set up in this trial?
No, Your Honor, there wasn't, because Ms. Evans didn't have that information. So that she's the one witness that they brought in, and she's the bar owner. She didn't produce the video.
That wasn't the only witness that was going to testify. There were additional troops on the way, if I recall it right, who would be in a position to offer additional testimony to authenticate the video, and the court was having none of that either. Am I right?
No, Your Honor. Actually, if you look at the record, and there's a discussion, especially a discussion about the video evidence, about the authentication witness early on in the transcript, and there was a conversation between counsel during the interim break, because keep in mind, this case came to trial on November 12th, and the state didn't have a witness to authenticate the video. And the state was warned, if you don't bring in that witness, this video will be excluded. So you come to the 25th, and there was an argument or the defense counsel was saying, hey, the state has still never disclosed to us who's going to authenticate this video. And the prosecutor attempted to say, well, it was a non-disclosed witness, and he said, was corrected in saying, we talked about this. You told me the only witnesses you were going to present was the detective and Mr. Kessler. So actually, those are the only two witnesses that were identified as going to be actually testifying at trial.
So could the bar owner testify that within that compiled video that she had viewed all of that video that was shown in there and that it was coming from her cameras at the bar? Could she give that much information about it?
That would be something similar to what the testimony was in Pickens, but that's not what we had here, because immediately that night of the shooting, the police seized the hard drive. And again, what we're talking is you have a hard drive, and we don't know how many days are on the hard drive, so that's why it would be important.
Oh, so she never actually viewed the video at all before the police confiscated it?
No, Your Honor, she did not. So that's why this is in distinction to the case in State versus Pickens and the other state that they cited, I believe it's State versus Green.
And she was their only authenticating witness?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Was the hours upon hours of video available for review?
For the defense counsel?
Yeah.
Well,
according to them, it was.
Well, according to the transcript, the defense counsel said, you didn't give us the video. We requested the video, and you, the only video that they supplied was the compilation video. So did the state represent that there was additional raw video footage that they, that the defense was not getting? That's not specified.
I can't find it either way.
In the,
that's why I'm asking the question.
Right. So the defense disputed that they never got the raw video footage.
They never had an opportunity, ever.
They weren't aware, because it wasn't disclosed that there was raw video footage, what you just see is that there was this representation that there was a surveillance video from the Chalet Bar, and then in discovery, they include that compilation video. So you put the two together, there's no reason for the defense to think that there was some additional video that they needed to go to the prosecutor or ask again to have it disclosed if they provided like a disc or, you know, for them to make a copy. That's part, I mean, so that's under the background, and that comes out in the transcripts, that there was this dispute as to whether or not this raw video footage was available. And when the trial court granted the motion to exclude the compilation video, it had nothing, that's not saying anything about whether or not the raw video footage would have been available to be admissible. Would have been admissible, like if they had decided to go to trial and say, okay, you excluded our compilation video because we didn't have an authentication witness, so here you go, trial court, now you have to watch the hours and hours of the raw video footage, which all we would have needed was then for someone to say that this was produced by a reliable surveillance video system. I would briefly like to mention that in addition to the trial court not error in making its ruling and that the TUI letter wasn't available and that the video wasn't properly authenticated, this court would be equally justified in dismissing this case as improvidently accepted. In the first and third propositions of law, they are based... Huh?
Thank you. Oh. You're over your time.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Springman, you have a minute 53 seconds left.
Oh, okay. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Just to add on the video authentication issue, as the court knows, it's not just a low bar. Some courts have described it as an extraordinarily low bar. But the state was not required to produce an expert testimony on the reliability of the surveillance system itself. That's in Pickens. It's also not necessarily that the person who authenticates the video under the silent witness theory observes the actual events.
But how could she identify it if she never got to see the video in the first place?
Your Honor, that's the record in this case shows that she did watch it, but it is confusing. And
did she watch it after it was compiled, or did she watch all the raw footage before it was compiled?
Oh, it was after it was compiled that she watched it. I think that's pretty clear in the record that she watched
She could say, yeah, this is my bar.
Right. She pointed out the features in her bar and said that Cincinnati Police Department retrieved the hard drive because...
But if somebody was crouching in a corner and the video caught that and it got cut out, She wouldn't know, right?
Well, the defense at trial can always subpoena in a witness.
Well, I kind of wanted to know what your thought was. Would she know?
Yes. Would she know?
If there's someone crouching in the corner with a gun and they got cut out of the video, would she have any knowledge that that happened?
That's something I don't know. I don't know how to answer. If it's a compilation video, I would assume that it's reliable and that she would be able to observe somebody.
But she didn't get a chance to see it because the police confiscated it. Then somebody took parts of the video and put it together in one compiled video,
right,
and that's all she saw. So if they cut out the part with somebody in a gun in the corner crouching, do you think she would have seen that?
No.
Me too.
You know, the hard drive was confiscated by the police in the normal course of business. They always do that. And I would say that that's an inference that demonstrates the reliability of the video surveillance system. They believe it's reliable. That's why they wanted that evidence. And this can, you know, remember, authentication is not an issue of admissibility. It's really a question of weight of the evidence. And those types of questions that you just asked me can be asked of a witness at trial if they want to establish that the video is not credible or something unreliable contained in that video.
Except we really, the hard part is this was a 12K appeal, so, and we never made it to trial, so we don't really have a record to understand how this would fit in.
Yes, John, that was my concern from the get-go, is that the way the proceedings were handled at the trial level and the conversion of the motion in limine into a motion to suppress really did hamper everyone. All as the state wanted in this case was to get it to trial. These were serious charges. A person was killed outside the bar. This defendant's accused of shooting someone in the bar, critically injuring them. These are very, very serious cases. And if all of this could have been avoided, if the judge would have truly treated this as a motion in limine and made a preliminary ruling, and then the state was going to make sure that it had the proper authentication witness, the compilation witness at trial. We were not going to quibble with the fact that we may not have needed that witness, that it was in line with, Pickens doesn't require that we have an expert witness to testify to the reliability of a surveillance video system. I cited Green, Bond, and Malo in my brief, and I cited them for the purposes is that Green involved a co-bar owner like this who never saw the actual events, was able to authenticate a video. Bond involved a store employee who was able to properly authenticate a video. And Malo is a homeowner who didn't see the events and was able to properly authenticate the video. So this is not new. This is somewhat common when we have video authentication witnesses who haven't observed the events, as long as they can testify to the reliability of the surveillance system, and that's what Pickens says. And again, it goes to weight of the evidence, not necessarily to the admissibility of the video. But again, if it did get to trial, it's very clear in the record the state wasn't going to take any chances. It was going to have the compilation expert available.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll receive a decision from the court.